when I first came to the court in the early 70s, I think we were at a time of transition in all those regards. Not so much at that time on the from a gender point of view, because in the court systems then and probably still today, the overwhelming majority of the employees were women at that time. So as far as employment was concerned, there was not much issue. There was not hardly any racial and ethnic diversity at the time. And I think that was, again, one of the great things that came about. I'm not sure that we did anything unusual and that times and everything else would not have accomplished the same thing. But I do know that we made great efforts to try to bring about diversity, first of all, in the workforce, and certainly always in treatment. That had some successes, not nearly as much as probably what we would have liked, but we did make a lot of progress on employing a more diverse workforce. And as I think I mentioned in an earlier comment, that we worked on such issues as sentencing guidelines to try to deal with disparity that might have existed because of, it could have been gender, but that really wasn't the case, but a lot of concern about racial disparity there. And so we spent a lot of time and effort on that. So it's one of those things that I think the courts in Virginia moved along with society. I think we were able to facilitate that some, and that was true at the Supreme Court as well as the courts throughout the state. Humorously, I recall, for example, when I first came to the court, I don't think this was written anyplace, but it was certainly a known policy, a rule, for example, that women could not wear pants, they had to wear dresses and everything. And of course, men always, until the end, certainly always wore coats and ties. So it was a very formal place, and that gradually changed over a period of time.
Spurred on by an individual?
Not really. You know, it was just, again, I think it mirrored society a little bit more. Things that had not been accepted as a standard business procedure or in the past by the people who were there, as you got younger people in, and as society changed, obviously you had just a general movement where it became sort of readily accepted. And so, as I said, I don't think there was anything that we did that particularly moved it one way or the other, but I do know that I felt proud about the fact that we did diversify the workforce while we were there. And it's always a constant issue of trying to ensure that the courts in the actual trial and litigation of cases ensure that they are fair to everybody, regardless of whether or not it be a physical or mental impairment or racial or whatever, that the courts treat everybody individually and treat everybody the same type of fairness. And so we were constantly putting together commissions, groups. We had, for example, I don't remember the time frame, this was a little bit later, but a gender bias task force, for example. And, you know, we would put together task forces like that who spent 6 months a year with a blue ribbon panel of people trying to ferret out issues and probably, as much as anything else, raise awareness about the issues so that you moved away from, and I think everybody did, from overt acts of discrimination to probably now things that are more latent and not as well understood. We did a great deal of training, I recall also, on racial and ethnic diversity. And that was interesting from the point of view. I guess you should have, or I should have anticipated the outcome, but for example, we would bring a group of judges and court employees and so forth, and we did training programs around the state. And again, trying to raise consciousness on racial and ethnic issues. And sometimes when you do that, it comes across to people as accusatory. And so we had a lot of problems, not a lot of problems, but we had issues to start off with that people were put on the defensive, because most everybody does not see themselves in any way, shape, or form as being discriminatory or having those types of biases. And yet, as you go through the exercises, sometimes you find out, or you always find out, that that is true, that everybody has some form of bias. And so that, I think, was what we were committed to, was trying to make sure that we did those things that raise consciousness of people, and I think we did.
I was wondering, generally, when people would perhaps, or it would be revealed that some of these people did have biases, generally speaking, how did they receive that knowledge, or were they in denial?
I think they would. I would say not everybody, but plenty of people would be in denial. I mean, again, it's just like if somebody walks up to you today and says, "You're not a fair person," and you're in a job that it's all about being fair. Well, that's rather confronting and disconcerting, and so most people react, I don't know if I should say a negative way, but they react in a way that they've been accused of something that they don't want to be accused of. But it's all a part of the process, I think, you know, and that, I think, eventually turns into a good thing, that once, if you have skilled facilitators, skilled trainers and people that are doing this, they're able to take that and work with that and show people that, you know, understanding where you are and who you are and what your biases are, that's the sort of the first step to learning. But I think lots of people respond to, sort of negatively to it when someone says that you're not perfect or you're not, fair in every single way.
Where did you typically go to get these facilitators?
There were plenty of consultants. Sometimes we used faculty and people from universities and so forth, but particularly at that point in time, again, this would have been probably in the early 80s, I'm guessing, through that. There were awful lot of people who were becoming experts and doing training in those areas, and we would look both nationally and around the state to the people that we thought could brought the greatest reputation and the greatest ability to them.
And how did you measure your level of success?
I can't say that we had any exact way to do that. Like everybody else, we would give the pre-test sort of things and to get your attitudes and approaches and opinions, and then at the end of the trainings, you always do a post-test type thing. But as far as going out and trying to translate and say how that did translate into actions in courtrooms or in clerks' offices or behavior on the scenes, we never had a formal way of doing that. One of the things that we always did as a part of our planning process, and we had a very sophisticated planning, comprehensive planning process, we always did a lot of public surveys of people and became, in later years, actually fairly sophisticated, I think, at doing that through telephone surveys and just like you would see in any other high-profile surveying type of operation. And for the most part, what we looked at there was we would ask questions about, how people felt, and obviously try to look at it from the point of view of what this particular race felt versus what this particular race felt about whether or not the treatment they were receiving in courts or the reputation of courts were fair. And there continued to be, obviously, a discrepancy between what white people felt was going on and what African American people felt. But again, I think we were satisfied that we were making small steps in that regard, that the opinion of the system was improving among all people. Still a long way to go. And in fact, that's one of the things when I look back on it that I really feel good about is the fact that we started from scratch in a way when the courts were reorganized, made an awful lot of changes, went through an awful lot of trauma in the country as a whole and the changes in the country, and yet at the end of the day, and we were still having in surveys we were doing roughly 80% of the people, generally 78, 79, 80% of the people say positive things about the courts in Virginia specifically. And while you'd like for it to be 100%, and that's never going to happen on anything, And so I always thought that was pretty good. If we had 80% of the people saying good things about it, I don't know what the numbers are today for other governmental things. You often hear comments about percentages being low for the legislature, for example, or for certain aspects of the government. But I think the courts in Virginia were generally seen to be in a good light. And I think part of that's because we had, contrary to maybe some areas of the country, we had a really, I think, a judiciary of very high integrity. And we didn't have scandals that you would hear about in lots of jurisdictions. I don't mean to imply that everything was perfect, but I do believe that most people thought that judges in Virginia and the system as a whole was a system of integrity. And so I think that helped contribute to the reputation of the courts being a good one.
How did these surveys get distributed and collected?
Well, most of the stuff we did was through telephone surveys. And we did paper surveys when it was internal, you know, within the court system and that type of stuff. But we would employ, again, public relations firms and people who did surveys, and, you know, they would come up with the criteria to make sure it was statistically verified and everything. And, you know, we would generally do, it varied, I think, but my memory is somewhere certainly over 1,000 telephone calls, you know, and maybe as sometimes as many as 1,600, so that we could, and sample throughout the state so that we got, you know, all parts of the state. So, and we also, at other points in time, we did some exit surveys at the courts. We actually gave out paper surveys of people to courts. That's a little bit less satisfactory way of getting things. But at one point in time, we had a project that we called Consumer Research and Development. I think it was the title, Consumer Research and Development Project. And the whole idea of the project was to basically look at the courts the way a private business sector would look at their business, and to employ the types of research, consumer research. What's the marketing say? And, but instead of asking about, you know, can we market this product, can we market something to this group of people or this segment of society and so forth, we tried to look at the different ways that they use things but apply them to a governmental model and to a court system model. So one of the things that we found was that you couldn't use any one method of sampling and believe that that was totally satisfactory. So we tried to use focus groups, we tried to use telephone surveys, we did paper surveys. This was before online and the internet, so we never were using those. But we used all the forms that we could find out of that businesses in society were using to gather the information.
Do you recall whether the results of the surveys changed once Virginia adopted a sentencing guideline for the judges?
Well, the surveys that we did wouldn't have gone into as much detail to pick that up, but I certainly, the Sentencing Commission people could probably offer some more insight to that, but I think I mentioned last time that one of the things that set off our efforts to do sentencing guidelines was an expose that was done by the newspaper, the Times Dispatch. And I do think that what was demonstrated later on, first of all, that there were some errors in that, because it was not basically, it didn't look at enough variables and enough factors to reach some of the conclusions that it reached. So I think that that was refuted to some extent, really just by the numbers. But then I think as we went to the sentencing guidelines, even though they were voluntary, when we first started, you could pick up that there were some, for example, there might be pockets of things where someone could say, well, race might have been a factor in a sentencing decisions there. And I do think, and I'm speaking here without being able to give you numbers and facts, but my memory is that decreased over a period of time. as you might would expect it would, because if people are by and large using guidelines and they're using that middle 50%, then, you know, most of the time that would alleviate some of that. So I think that was a positive trend there.
Going back to your efforts to diversify and to make people aware, did any of that translate into the kinds of people who were hired? Did you see increased diversity among the clerks of court, in the administrative or on the administrative side of the courtroom, not just the judge side?
Some. Again, probably not as much as you would like, and I think that's on all levels, starting at the Supreme Court. Again, I think that there was a big change and an increase in diversity there, but still the numbers, and without being able to remember exactly, still, you know, we would probably have in the 10 to 15% category or something like that. So it was never large, but it was progress from where it started. And I think that was mirrored around the state. It again, depended upon the area of the state you were in. Obviously, some areas of the state, they lag behind in the numbers. But we, of course, had to file various reports with the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission and so forth. So we had to collect all those numbers on age, race, sex, and so forth about the workforce and file those each year. And so those numbers were there and they improved, but it was not by leaps and bounds, you know, types of improvement. It was by just incremental types of things. The interesting thing about both judges and clerks of circuit court, at least, is that the method of selection controls everything, really. And so those methods of selection, when, for example, the circuit court clerks are popularly elected, that's not set up, you know, in essence, to try to create diversity. It just produces whatever it produces, whatever the populace produce. And the same thing, maybe slightly lesser, but the same thing is true with judges. Judges were, in fact, obviously selected by the legislature. And so while there's more of an opportunity to take diversity into account there, again, it's reflective of first of all, one of the things that was always such a big discussion back in the early days was as to gender and as to race for judges, is that you started out with not very many women and not very many African Americans were in law schools. And so the pool of people to select. You had to be a lawyer to be a judge, and if there was only 5% of the legal population, of the lawyer population, that was female or was African American, then, you know, you could understand just by those numbers that was not going to translate into large numbers of judges. And that continued for some time, because not only did you have those small numbers, but even as those numbers start to increase, obviously those people were junior in the profession. And so generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, judges come from a more senior category of the bar. So it took a length of time before enough women and then enough African Americans got into the legal profession with some seniority in that profession that you started to see them come in into judgeship. So I think on those two things, the clerks and the judges, the method of selection plays a lot as to what diversity you have. On the workforce in general, then that's a selected thing, and that's no different from any other organization, any other business.
Well, I was wondering, as you're trying to help educate people about the importance of diversity and get them to see themselves, what other major challenges did you face in this period of the late 80s going into the 1990s?
Other than the diversity
other
issues?
Other than the diversity issues.
Well, there were plenty, but let me just try to... The major effort in the late 80s, let me mention two things. In 19, I believe it started in 87 and finished in 89, we had a commission on the future of the court system, of the judicial system in Virginia. And I think that was one of the most significant events and achievements up to that date, because it basically pulled together a blue ribbon panel of people from around the state, from all walks. It was chaired by then president of the University of Virginia, Robert O'Neill. And we spent 2 years trying to figure out what the judicial system of Virginia should look like 20 years from now. And that was a lot of fun. It led to a lot of great ideas and a lot of changes. And so a lot of the challenges that I might talk about are things that are mentioned in the Futures Commission as things that we should be doing. But specifically in the late 80s and early 90s, probably one of the biggest things that we worked on and were not successful in, one of my biggest regrets, is the creation of a family court. Virginia has a juvenile domestic relations district court, which might be said to be very much like what a traditional, some would call a traditional family court, but the major difference is it does not have divorce and it does not have adoption. Those are both matters that are heard by the circuit court. And so there are lots of reasons why we thought that a consolidated family court with all jurisdiction related to juvenile delinquency, as well as to all family matters, including adoption, divorce, support, custody, all of those types of things, ought to be in one place. And we were able to get through a pilot project, which was a sort of an unusual way of going about it, but we actually changed the law as to 10 jurisdictions in the state and had a 2-year pilot project. And they ran successfully, were evaluated well by everybody. We then put in legislation and got the legislation adopted to create family courts for every place in Virginia. And we chose, from a strategy point of view, to do that in steps. It was because of, now we're into the early 90s and there was a recession in the early 90s, and so, as always, there was no money to go around. So what we chose to do was go for the legislation 1 year, and we were to come back the next year and get the funding, because it was going to be a major effort, because it was the next big step after we got the Court of Appeals. I mean, we were making major structural changes to the court system in Virginia. And so first we had the reorganization, then we had the Court of Appeals, now it's the Family Court. And we just thought it would be hard for people to swallow the whole thing at one time. As it turned out, I still think that was the right decision, but it turned out it came out wrong, so it must have been the wrong decision. But we created the, got the legislation through. The one thing we did not take into account was that there was an election in between. That was the election in which Mary Sue Terry was the candidate for governor and George Allen was the candidate for governor. And that, when George Allen won that election, it brought a total change from what had existed over the last, I guess, by that time, there had been like 3 straight Democratic governors, I guess, and Rob Blaus and Wilder. So you had basically 12 years of one sort of philosophy and approach and so forth, and you had a major shift in that. And that was the beginning of also bringing into government a reduced size of government, no taxes, all of those types of things. And so we come into the legislature to get funded, this new big thing, in a year that you had a recession going on and a major philosophical shift in the leadership of the Commonwealth. And we were going to fund it with some actually very small increases in fees in traffic cases and some other things. And we were criticized, we called them user fees, and today whenever you're in favor of it, it's a user fee, and whenever you're opposed to it, it's a tax. And so the people who were opposed to the family court said this was a tax. And the bottom line was we lost, and it was defeated. And so 2 years of successful efforts went away and went down the tubes. And again, I think today there have been, it's sort of interesting, as we talked about this, I always used to say when I was testifying and talking to the legislature about the family court. And I'm sure there may have been others before this, but the first study to create a family court that I looked at was dated 1948. And so we were now in 19, by then it was 1993. So, you know, we were just unbelievable, you know, 45 whatever years later, still talking about something that people thought, some people at least thought was a good idea back then. And we weren't able to get that through. And they've had, even since that time, I think even since I left, there was another partial effort, at least, to try to get the family court through. So that was a major, major effort. Again, it's not that the system as it is doesn't function all right, but it is one of the things that we talked about at that time. Children, are, for example, are put through such a trauma because so many things go on in the JNDR court now, and there's a de novo appeal to the circuit court, so they've got to go back through that again. And it goes the other way with the divorce. The divorce happens in the circuit court, and generally that's referred for enforcement and child support and custody and those types of things to the JNDR court. And then you've got, in those families, sometimes you have children who are involved in juvenile delinquency matters and so forth, and people don't know where they're going, what they're doing. They're seeing different judges at different times, and they're telling their stories over and over and over again. And the whole thrust of the effort was, to use a sort of play on some other political language, but one judge, one family, that you got to the ability to have some judge deal with this family and all the things that were associated with that family as far as the legal system is concerned. Still sounds like a pretty good idea, and maybe someday it will happen, but that was the first thing that popped in my mind when you talk about challenges of that time.
Explain what the philosophical difference really is in the objection that, say, Governor Allen had, as well as, I would say, probably the majority of the Republican legislators to a family court. Exactly what was the issue?
I wouldn't say that Governor Allen was necessarily opposed to it. I think it was just a general philosophy that came in at that time of smaller government and no increases in, you know, funding and no taxes. But there were the political issues probably were one that, again, it's got to raise money, and so this is going to be a tax increase. Two, it was creating a bunch of new judgeships, and we were going to have to move judgeships around, so that was causing, you know, a little bit of stir, but it was creating new judgeships too. And my view, and I have no way of knowing it, if this is true, this is purely speculation on my part, but obviously at that point in time, while Governor Allen had won, I believe the Democrats were still in control of one, if not both, houses of the legislature. Well, if you're sitting there in the minority and somebody is coming to you with a bill that says we're going to have 25 new judges elected, and you think maybe a year or two from now I might be in the majority and I would get to appoint who those 25 judges are, wouldn't you drag your feet and say, let's wait a while because I might win and I might be able to make those appointments? So I think that was part of it. We also got into a big flap, again, I think erroneously so, but with the localities, because the courthouse is still provided by and funded by the locality. And so many of the localities, notwithstanding we had the numbers and the facts and the figures to disprove this, but many of the localities came out opposed to this because they said they would have to build new courthouses and they would have to renovate courthouses. And we demonstrated, to our satisfaction at least, unequivocally, that was not the case. But what, as you might expect, would happen, and I don't begrudge anyone from doing this, but somebody who always wanted a new courthouse or whose courthouse was dilapidated and ready for renovation and so forth, if they could use this as a reason to say, oh, well, now this is going to cause us, we could have made it if we didn't have this, but now we're going to have a new judge, and so we're going to have to build a whole courthouse. We even had one place that I won't name, but they were going to build like a $12 million parking deck because of, you know, the creation of the family court, which was going to be adding two or three judges in that jurisdiction. So that, you know, the legislatures were catching it from their local officials, their governmental officials, and all those other issues that I talked about. And then you didn't have as strong a support for it internally as what we would have liked. Circuit judges who, you know, they probably had initially had some concerns about it. Some of them then felt, oh, it's okay because we're going to get rid of some work. We're going to, the divorces and stuff are going to go down. But originally, it was looked at as, okay, the circuit judges are at a little bit higher level than the JNDR judges, and this is a little bit higher level of work, and we don't want to give this up. Then it sort of started to move around to the other side of, well, maybe it's not so bad to give up this extra work. And then the JNDR judges were looking at this, well, if we're now going to be doing that, then we ought to get paid as much as they are. And so, and there is a difference, it's relatively minor, but there is a difference in the salaries between the two levels of judges. So they were discontent a little bit about that. And of course, they were discontent about the fact that it was going to be more work and more clerk's office people. And we did studies, very detailed studies, and came up with, you know, how many judgeships were needed and how many people were needed. And then, in all honesty, we almost always added far more than we thought was actually necessary. Because at the same time, we were doing a major effort to get a lot of these cases put into mediation. So we're going to, as a part of this change, bring in mediators so that much of the litigation in the domestic area could be mediated. And yet we still are adding enough judges and enough people to handle the workload as if none of it were going to be mediated. And yet still, you know, people grumbled. So you had almost every component of your constituency not being on board 100%. You know, some were on board and some were against, but it wasn't like we were able to go for it with one voice. We had that hardcore group of people that were supportive, but it wasn't like we could go for it with one voice. Another thing, shifting, if I'll say these while they pop into my mind, but another major effort along that time, that my comment about mediation reminded me of that, is that one of the recommendations that came out of the Futures Commission was that we basically create alternative dispute resolution, as it was referred to at that time. Multiple options. The Futures Commission actually referred to it as creating a multi-door courthouse. That was sort of the in vogue thing. Mediation had become popular in this country in probably in the early 80s. And I actually held up a little bit because, wrongly again, but thought it was a passing fancy. But by the mid-80s, it became clear to me that that was not the case, and this was something that was going to be very beneficial for the citizens and for the courts. And
can you explain what you mean by passing fancy?
Well, so many times there are ideas that come along that everybody jumps on. You do it for 6 months, a year, 5 years, and it fizzles. And, you know, then it's not something that gets institutionalized, and it's not something that demonstrates over the long haul that it is an improvement or successful. And I guess I was thinking that there's just got to be more time for this to demonstrate its usefulness. And in fact, that's what happened, or at least as far as I was concerned, you know, by the mid-80s, we started to see, well, this is happening enough around the country. It doesn't look like it's going to go away. Of course, I probably should have figured that out because that's been going on for a couple thousand years, you know, in the rest of the world. But so we made a very concerted effort to start talking about having the courts have disposition options that we used to use the phrase that we wanted to make the forum fit the fuss. And the idea was that you have the adversarial process now, but I think people even then, and even more so today, have decided that the adversarial process is not good for all types of disputes. And the first place they found that out was that it's not good in family disputes. When you've got people at odds with each other, the worst thing you can do is bring them into a dispute resolution mechanism that pits them against one another. And what hopefully the better approach is to using skilled people and facilitators and so forth that put them in a situation where they might be able to learn how to work together. Good behavior gets modeled for them when they move on out after the dispute is over. So we formalized our efforts, created a dispute resolution services department in our office, brought in a really top flight person, Barbara Hulbert, to be the head of that department. And then went about trying to basically inculcate mediation into the court system, starting mainly with family matters, but moving really into all types of matters. And that effort is still expanding even as today. Again, I think a major, major triumph, because we still don't do as much of that as what we probably should. But many states, it's mandatory. We did not make it mandatory, but what we tried to do was to first certify mediators, to try to make sure that you had people who knew what they were doing, and we set up all the training education programs, and we became the certifying entity. And then we tried to make them available, and what I mean by that is provide some way to fund that, because these were not people who were on the payroll. They're not employees. These are people who are out there, and some of them trying to do this for a living, most of them doing some other professional job, but just doing this on the side, and because they enjoyed it and liked it. And so we had to find a way to pay them, and so we looked for a number of different ways to try to get enough money to give them at least a small amount, $100 for, you know, every case that they would mediate.
Did you all have certain educational requirements for these mediators?
There was never a situation, at least at start, that said they had to have a college degree or something like that, but there were training and experiential requirements that went into it. So that's the way, you know, we satisfied that. And that's just continued to move on. And one of the things that in the last couple of years that I was there was to move that into really civil cases that are, you know, contracts or tort cases or just about money or property or whatever, not just about family matters. And that was, I think, encouraged and took off a lot when the private sector got into this game. The McCammon Group, to mention a name, John McCammon, did a fabulous job of looking at the market and saying, this is something that is ripe. He went out and set up, he was a lawyer, quit practicing law, went out and set up a private mediation firm, and has just been hugely successful. And it popularized it among the real practicing bar, not, as I said, not just the family bar, but among the real practicing bar. And the what happened was, in addition, he was able to use as his stable of people to do mediation retired judges. So when a judge retired, and if it somebody who was well-liked, well-respected, well-thought-of, John would recruit them to serve as a mediator for them. And that's been a tremendously successful business model. I can't tell you how many, I used to kid judges at our orientation sessions. We would do an orientation session for new judges, and one of the things we talked about was retirement. I always joked that it was funny that we were talking about retirement at the orientation session, but we were trying to give them information. And one of the things we said there was that the retirement for most judges now was to go to mediation and do mediation. But that popularized it a lot. And it also led to another idea that we had that I think has been wildly successful, and that is that we have recalled judges. A circuit court judge who's retired can, through order of the Chief Justice, be recalled to active duty. And that can be for a period of time, or that can be for a given case. And they're paid basically just on a per diem basis, and there's a budget for that. And what we finally looked at it and said, well, why don't we train those people as mediators? And then instead of recalling them to try these cases, we can help out the sitting judges by getting a lot of cases off their docket by recalling these people to mediate these cases. And that's what we did. And so we brought in and took, you know, retired judges, been around 20, 30 years or something, and we put them through these training programs. And that has, again, been, I think, a great way to help reduce the delay in the dockets, particularly the civil dockets, to try to give the regular judges more time to concentrate and to focus on cases that, that do go to trial. Because the bottom line is that for most civil cases, 85 to 90% of civil cases, they settle generally anyway. They generally don't go to trial. You know, I'm talking about cases in a circuit court. And so if they're going to settle, then the idea is, well, let's try to make them settle early on rather than the last minute and save everybody, litigants and everybody, a lot of expense, a lot of time. And the one way to do that is to give them a vehicle to resolve their dispute early on. And so that's what we said we would do, is, okay, we will recall that person. We could use the existing budget we were using for retired judges recall to pay them on that per diem basis. And they could come in, get a good resolution many times in the case, and get a case off the docket. So that was another major achievement.
Were these mediation scenarios choices that people could make, or were these mandated by the court?
We've never used mandated. I'm sure some of the lawyers probably think it's like that, because if a judge says, why don't you try mediation, many lawyers would think that's not a voluntary choice. That's a recommendation that has a much stronger meaning to it. So, but it was, that's the way it was. We asked the judges to look at cases that they would, in fact, think would be resolvable through that. And what was happening on the other end, back to my original statement about John McCammon's group, and there are other groups out there. His is the largest and was the first. That's why I'm alluding to it. But they were getting stuff on what I'll call the front end. That is, many times they were getting cases for mediation prior to the case ever even being filed in court. So we didn't even know about that case. The cases that I was just describing, those are cases that are obviously already filed and they're in court, and then they're just being, in essence, referred out of court or over here to this other alternate dispute resolution option. Now, there are other things in the ADR community other than mediation. I think that's been the most successful. Of course, you do have arbitration. There's another thing that Fairfax used a little bit of called early neutral evaluation. And that's more where, the, again, you get an experienced attorney that sits down with the parties and their lawyers and sort of listens to the story and gives them a sense, okay, well, you know, this, based on my experience, you know, this is worth this or it's not worth anything or whatever. And it helps foster settlement because it gives a realistic picture of it. And all of these things have sort of different levels of involvement by the facilitator. Even within mediation, you have what's called evaluative mediation and facilitative mediation. And facilitative mediation is basically what's done more in the family court arena, where it truly is the third party who is just there trying to help the people identify the issues and work their way through it. Evaluative mediation is a little bit more like what goes on in circuit court cases, generally when they're about issues of money. Somebody says someone else owes me money, either because of an accident or a contract. And so there, what the lawyers and the parties are looking for on occasion, or most of the time, is someone, again, with experience to be, tell them what this is worth and show them where their weaknesses and where their strengths are. And that's why John McCammon's model of having retired judges and our model of using retired judges was so successful, because here are people who've been doing that for 20, 25 years. They could come in and, you know, they couldn't say what a jury do, because juries, you know, will do wildly different things on occasion. But they could come in and say, over my experience now, here are the types of things. And that was the evaluative model. The purist, like the facilitative model, where the mediator doesn't get involved in saying what things are worth. But just as a practicality of life, the evaluative model has proven to be very popular in certain matters dealing with money.
Now, you've talked about some of these ideas and the changes, and I was wondering how some of those ideas germinated. Was this the result of discussions that you would have with the Chief Justice, or did this come from your office staff and personnel or other outside entities?
I'd probably say all of the above. You know, basically, one great thing about this is that every state has someone called a state court administrator by some title or name. So the job that I had, that existed in every state in the country. And we, that group of people were part of a conference called the Conference of State Court Administrators. And there's also a Conference of Chief Justices. And those two groups met together once a year, and they met separately one other time a year. So you basically, twice a year, on a formal basis, meeting face-to-face, were with people in every state in the union talking about what they were doing. And I used to always say, and it was true, that I'd tell the people back in my office, and they hated to see me go to one of those conferences because when I came back, you know, I always came back with work for them to do. But I always used to say that I could serve out my entire career and never have an original thought and still have tremendous things be done, because all you had to do was go find out what some other state is doing. And we were better than some states in some areas, we were worse in some states in some areas. I don't know about competition, it's the right thing, but there is peer pressure exists. If you go to a meeting and you find out there are 30 states that are doing this, there are 30 states that have mediation programs. We were always one of the leaders when it came to the centralized automation. We were one of the few states that had a statewide centralized automation services. And we were one of the leaders in the area of comprehensive planning and things like that. So we learned through what others were doing. And at the same time, I mentioned that we had this comprehensive planning process. That's what that was about. Kathy Mays came in 1980 as our director of planning, and she and I retired on the same day. And her 25 years later and my 30 years, I guess, later. But her job was, on a more formal basis, to do the research and stay abreast of what was going on in all of the jurisdictions and to study these types of issues. So it was our job each year to, let me drop back and say, once we did the Futures Commission thing, the model was slightly different before that, but once we did the Futures Commission, the model was every 10 years we need to do this long-term look, and that was a Futures Commission. Then in between the 10-year period, then we would do 2-year plans based on the budget cycle. And then as an office, we would take those 2-year plans and create a 1-year operational plan. So we had this long-term, pie-in-the-sky, futuristic view. We would pull from that into smaller bits for a 2-year piece, and then out of that 2-year piece, we would pull from that a 1-year operating budget. And that was the document. You recall earlier I mentioned that I would go into the Chief Justice and say, here's what we think we need to be doing in this next year. But that was always out of these other two efforts that had already been participated in by everybody. And that planning exercise involved everybody. You know, our office would do the basic staff work, but the bottom line was we then would bring that to people like the Committee on District Courts and the Judicial Council, which was chaired by the Chief Justice. And those groups would then debate, discuss, and agree or disagree. Most of the time they went along, but sometimes they didn't. And so everybody got involved. We were the staff of it. We were there to generate the ideas and do the legwork and put together the business case, if you will, for these changes. And then there were policymaking groups that were there to bring their experience and expertise and say yes or no, or we ought to amend or go in a different direction. But I can't overstate how much we got from others. I mean, from from people around the country, because it was just such a, and still is today. I mean, as a part of my current job, I'm still involved with that group of people. And I'm always amazed to go to those things and to see and hear the discussion that goes on.
What time of year do they typically meet?
The annual meeting that they both meet together is always the last couple days of July, first couple days of August. And then the chiefs have a mid-year meeting in the last, generally last week in January, and the state court administrators, their mid-year meeting is generally the first week in December.
Were there any states that you particularly admired?
I probably would get in trouble if I left somebody out of saying that, but there were a number of states, and sometimes this vacillated, obviously, with the people in leadership positions in those states. In other words, when X was in as the state court administrator or as the chief justice in the state, they became widely known as being progressive and doing lots of things. And when those people left, maybe lesser so. You know, sometimes there was continuity, but I was amazed over the years, and sometimes I wondered whether or not it was because the state was doing something far differently, or it was just those first guys were great marketers and good talkers, and you know they talked about themselves in such a way that you thought they were doing well. But California has always done, I think, an exceptional job. I mean, I don't think I'm wrong in saying this, but if I am, I'm only slightly off. But California has the biggest judicial system in the world, and they, you know, their system is bigger than the federal system. I probably don't know as much about China, so I'm not sure I'm totally accurate. But you know, China's is, I'm sure, also dispersed and much more so than California's. But they clearly have the biggest judicial system in this country and in North America. So they obviously are were a place. And the other thing about them is that is in so many things, they seem more willing to try things that are different, and to go out there and to be, I don't know if progressive is the right word, but just to try and to experiment and not to be afraid to fail. So California was always one. And again, I could name Minnesota, actually, in the last 20 or so years has been very strong. At one time, Alabama was very good. And as I said, I would, for fear of leaving, and I already am leaving somebody out, but there were a number of states that, and the great thing, again, we talked earlier about some of the good or bad things about being around for a long time. Well, one of the good things about it is that you built friendships. And many times, some of these, the state court administrator jobs turned over a lot because they were attached to whomever the chief was. In so many states, particularly where you had elected judges, and you had a new elected chief justice come in, often that meant the end of whomever that state court administrator was. And that would not be unusual and well accepted. But there were some that stayed around for long periods of time. And so you got to know those. And again, that was like I mentioned before with our office, a lot of us grew up together. The fellow who is now the state court administrator in California, Bill Vickery, was the state court administrator in Utah prior to that. And when you go to these national meetings, you sit in a big round table or a big square table by alphabet of the states. So I was always seated next to Bill Vickery or close to him by virtue of our alphabet. And so I got to know him long before he went to California. But you know, he was a number of years there and a number of years in California. And there are, I was going to say handful, probably more than a handful of people who've been around an awful long time. Very experienced, very capable, and learned an awful lot from those people.
Well, speaking of friendships and ties to chief justices, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the chief justice that you served the longest under, which was Chief Justice Carrico.
Chief Justice Carrico, I think I mentioned earlier, was just a prototypical chief justice. I think he epitomized what people would want to see in a judge, and they'd want to see in the chief justice, the leader of the system. He was a person of intellectual ability and intellectual integrity. He was a gentleman in the truest sense, in the best sense of that statement. He had an unbelievable work ethic, and he had served on all the courts that existed when he came along. So he had experience at the lowest level as well as at the highest level. And of course, he had done it for such a long period of time. He was on the Supreme Court for 42 years and as Chief Justice for 22 years. And sometimes now, I always think back now to try to relate how old I am now to how old he was and where I was relative to that. And I'm always amazed that he could do what he could do at that age and feeling like I feel right now. And, you know, he was an avid horseman. He rollerbladed well into his 80s. And I'm serious about that. That's not an overstatement. So he was a genuinely good person, I think. So I think he represented the system well, and in fact was a part of the reason that I described earlier that the courts were thought of as so well, because people obviously see a public face of the system, and if you like that face, that helps. And I think people like that face. So I think extremely highly of him, and I couldn't have been more pleased to have worked with him over that period of time.
Now, when you say that he had an incredible work ethic, explain what you mean.
Well, he was always there by 7:30 every day, and he was always there till probably at least 6, if not more. And when I say every day, I'm talking about every day. He worked at home, and he continued working long after he could have obviously retired. You know, Virginia, unless they changed it, I haven't followed it since I left, but the mandatory retirement age was 70. But when he reached 70, he was grandfathered because he came in under a system where he could have served longer. And so he was concerned about serving on past 70, but he talked to a number of legislators and so forth, and everybody agreed. Again, everybody was so fond of him, everybody agreed that that would be nothing inappropriate about it. It was certainly appropriate legally and otherwise. He was grandfathered. So, again, if you think about it, and he still goes to work today, as far as I know, even though his health has fallen a little bit. But here's somebody who is in their 80s dealing with complicated legal issues, writing, reading, and in debate and discussion. Again, I don't think there are many people around that in their 80s you could see maintain that level of mental acuity and just energy to do things. Again, I think I said before, he never turned down a speaking engagement. He was always going to a courthouse dedication. And I do a good bit of travel right now, and I know after a while that gets you, you know, that wears you out. It's sometimes nicer to go home and rest in the evening, but he would, you know, might go to Southwest Virginia to help dedicate a courthouse the next day. So just a delightful person and a very great representative.
Now, you knew when he arrived in the morning. Did that mean that you were there already?
Well, I got there early, too, but I'll have to confess, he generally was there before me. I worked long hours, too, but I tell you, I had nothing on him, I'll say that.
So tell me a little bit about your interaction with him. When would you usually meet with him, and what were those meetings like?
Well, we had a relationship, and I often thought later, I hope this was all right with him, but his office was directly above mine. And I was on the third floor, and he's on the fourth floor in the same sector of the building. And this was after we moved. In 1980, we moved to, maybe 81, we moved to what was the old Federal Reserve Bank in Richmond. We had been in the then Supreme Court Library of Virginia building, but the state purchased the Federal Reserve Bank. We helped go through renovating that, went through all of that, and got that done and moved in 81, I think. And because that was an old building, fortress building with a three-story vault and everything, It, one of the things it also had that they kept and didn't change, there was a private elevator. I mean, literally, it was big enough for maybe two people, but it was very small, that ran. It was literally right outside my office and on the back of my office, and it ran off four floors from his office to the first floor. But so I certainly would go to his office three or four times a day, you know, on anything that came up that I felt like I had to share information with him or whatever, or if, obviously if he had some issue or question. So I would just run up and down on that elevator, you know, all day long. So we didn't have a situation. I know this exists in some places where there's a more formalized thing where, you know, you have a, okay, we're going to meet every Monday at 9 o'clock or something like that. But ours, for better or worse, and it was an on the go, on the flow type of relationship and meeting. And to me, that was the better thing, because many things come up and don't, they're not things that can wait, that you've got to talk about and wait for a week. You've got to resolve them now. So you have to have the ability. Well, nothing pops right to my head right off the bat, but lots of times there might be something about the legislature. I mean, that would be something. You have categories, I'll say. If it's during the legislature, you would have a situation where, you know, we're working on trying to either get a bill passed or trying to get a bill killed or whatever, and some issue has come up with a given legislator that I think he needs to know about that because it may become a political turmoil or something like that. Or we've got to decide what we're going to do. Are we going to go forward on this? Are we going to drop it or whatever? And we got to decide right now. There were often also issues that would come up with out in the court system. You know, there'd be cases that we had to assign a judge to. That's another one of the functions of the chief, but our office basically did the legwork on that, and he signed the orders. And so an issue might come up, an election recount, or if someone disqualified themselves out of a very serious murder trial or something like that, then, you know, you got to go talk to him and find out, okay, this is what we're trying to work on. We're trying to get this judge. Do you think that judge is going to be okay in that? Those types of things. There are probably dozens of other things that just don't jump to my mind right now. But it's just like in any work environment, you want it to be first a communications tool, and then secondly, if necessary, a decision-making tool. Now, we had formal times, obviously, when, as I said, he was the chair of the Judicial Council, and the Judicial Council met once a month, and the Committee on District Courts met once a month. And so, you know, we would put together agendas, and certainly I would go over the agenda with him as chair of the meeting to, you know, talk about what ought to be on the agenda and those types of things, and what do we want to do with those types of things. But, you know, generally speaking, it was just what was happening today. That was the thing that we needed to talk about.
Did you have much interaction with the rest of the justices on the court?
I had as much as was needed. Not all of them lived in Richmond. And so the ones that didn't live in Richmond, it was obviously less. But the ones that lived in Richmond, it was not as much on a operational basis, and it was generally more on a social basis. Or if, for example, the Chief Justice was out of town, he, for example, would delegate responsibility to another justice to sign certain orders, to sign things like appointing judges or so forth, things that we might work on. So I would deal with them in that regard. And then when we dealt with any bigger issues on some occasions, he would obviously have me come and present the issue to the court as a whole. But I was trying to remember, probably hardly ever more than three or four lived in town. I could go back and count exactly, but you know, there were always people who lived far away, and so obviously you could talk to them on the phone. But they generally, at that point in time, I think it's changed a little bit today, but at that point in time, the justices saw their primary role as trying cases and writing opinions, and they were not as actively involved then with the administration of the rest of the system. And that was what my responsibility was. And so that's why we didn't have as much interaction. I think many of the justices have become more involved today in that, but during the time when Chief Justice Carrico was chief and when I was there, it was more that was left to the chief and to our office and the other justices saw themselves as writing opinions.
Why do you think it's changed over the last few years?
I'd only be speculating, but I think probably you got a younger group of judges that came on the court, justices. I think maybe many of them came on with a bent toward improvement in administration, some of them having been in the trial courts and saw things that needed to be done there. It's just, the best I could say is it's just a different philosophy. I mean, some people, some of the older judges who'd been around on the court before when I first came, probably it was that way because there wasn't much administration going on in the courts, you know, back in before the reorganization. So the judges didn't think about that. And so when they came on the Supreme Court, they wouldn't be thinking about any issues like that because there wasn't anything around to administer. But now, after 25 years of that, the people who are coming on the court have been exposed to all of these issues. Many of them have worked in other groups like the American Bar Association and groups like that on issues surrounding improvements to the administration of justice. And I think because they came on the court a little bit younger, I think all of those reasons, probably some others that I'm not remembering, but those are reasons why I believe that there's been a far more interest in doing it.
Now, you had alluded to some socializing that went on, and I was hoping that you could relay some interesting, perhaps, events or situations that you had on a social level with the justices and extending that even to your staff.
Well, I'm not a good storyteller, but I'll say I was trying to remember. It's amazing how when you ask those questions, you know, certain things pop in your head, and I have no reason why I would know that. But two popped in my head as you were saying that actually involved Chief Justice I. Anson, who was the chief prior to Carrico. But I remember, for example, maybe I remember this because I was so new and this was a little more formal, but at this annual meeting I was telling you about where the Conference of State Court Administrators and Conference Chief Justice meet, we were having a meeting in Burlington, Vermont, I believe it was, and one of the social events in the evening was a big lobster bake, if you will, and so we were, you know, we were right out here in New England with these just huge, they probably were Maine lobsters, even though we were in Vermont, right on the banks of Lake Champlain, and I'm sitting there, and Chief Justice Anson's sitting about where you are, and I'm sitting, my wife was with me, I was sitting this side, and so I'm cracking these lobsters, and I just sprayed this huge spray of water and lobster gook or whatever all over, you know, the Chief Justice, and he looked at me, and again, this was when I was still relatively new, and he looked at me and said, "Rob, I took a shower this morning," And then another story, this one is another one that actually, and I told this, I guess while it jumped in my mind, I told this to another group I spoke to one time, but it was indicative of, I think, a different time, a different era, but it also involved Chief Justice I. Anson. That same conference, the CCJ and COSCA conference that I talked about, had the annual meeting in 1975. That would have been the first full year that I was back there at the Homestead in Virginia. So that meeting rotates around and goes to every state, and every state tries to outdo the other state on, you know, how they, what type of program they put on. And Chief Justice Anson was also a great host and very cordial and, you know, worked the room and just was great at being a host at events like that. And I remember going to that event, and my wife went with us, and so she came in one evening, and she walked by me, and I looked at her, and the back of her dress was soaking wet. It was just truly soaking wet. And I said, "What in the world happened?" And we were young. We were young. And she said, "Well, I was outside, and Chief Justice Anson's wife, and Justice Harrison," who was Governor Harrison before, his wife, and one other person whom I'm not remembering, wanted to play bridge, and they needed a fourth. And so my wife volunteered to be the fourth. Now, my wife is probably 29 years old, and she's sitting out on the veranda of the homestead playing bridge with the former First Lady of Virginia and with the current Chief Justice's wife and with somebody else equally impressive. And it started to rain, and she had her back to the outside, and it just rained all over. And yet she had enough of respect for those people. And I said, well, why didn't you get up and move? And she said, I would have never thought to have done that, because she had enough respect for those people and the positions that they held, and for their, and they were all older at the time. And obviously, as I said, she was young, that, you know, she just sat there and let it rain all over. And I told that story once before because of the fact that, to show a difference in era and a difference in time, that I don't know that people have that same respect for their seniors and for people in positions of authority as they did then. And maybe that speaks more to us than it does to anything else. But, you know, those are a couple things. That the events that those annual meetings, I could tell you 100 stories about those meetings, because they there's a folklore of things that happened at those things, and it's just it's amazing. Every year we go to those, and the people who are still left tell the exact same stories and things like that. So
have any of those stories been collected?
Well, we have done histories, but the histories are a little more formal. Both the Conference of Chiefs and the Conference of Statehood Administrators have done histories. But I will tell you, again, I hate to waste time, but I will tell you one of my many favorites. I have hundreds of favorites. But in 1976, those two conferences met, the bicentennial. They met in Philadelphia as part of the bicentennial, and late August. And this was, probably all of you guys are too young to know this, but this was right before there was a meeting of the American Legion Convention at the Bellevue Stratford Hotel in Philadelphia. And we now know the punchline to this story, but we certainly didn't know it at the time. But the week before, the American Legion had their convention at the Bellevue Stratford. The next week, it's us. They go home, and in that interim week, 19 people died around the country from what they didn't know at the time, but what we now have come to know as Legionnaires' disease. And so first we had the decision of whether or not to go to the meeting, because, you know, it's the same hotel. And then so we went, and then two quick, just funny things now that weren't funny then, but every night on national TV there was another scientist or someone speculating what was the cause of all these people dying. And we're going to meetings right here in the same place that they all. And it, as it turned out, you know, it was something to do with the ventilation and the system. So, but one of the nights I recall, I was staying in the hotel room getting ready to go to a social event, and I had one of those little plastic glasses and drinking some Coke or something. And I'm watching the national news, Walter Cronkite, somebody like that. And they had this person come on, and they said, well, we have this new theory as to what's causing all these deaths. And what is that? And I forget the chemical compound, but he said it's because of whatever, nickel phosphate. You know, I don't know what it was, but some compound like that. And the interviewer says, and where's that primary located? And he says, well, the best place, I think, is in those little plastic glasses that you see in hotel rooms. And I threw the glass up in the air. And then the final piece of this one was that, and this is not so much about the Virginia situation, but it's just a funny story to me. So when you check out of the hotel, now this is disconcerting. You go to check out of the hotel, and they say, okay, in addition to checking out here, you need to check out on the second floor with the Center for Disease Control. And that takes you back a little bit when they say, okay, you've got to go to CDC and check out before you can leave this place. So we go up there, I go up there, and I go in, and they interview you and tell you this stuff, and then they give you a little list of things, and they say, if you get any of these symptoms, you call the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta immediately. I take them, because it was in Philadelphia, my wife and I had driven. So I go down, we get in the car. Before we hit the Philadelphia city limits, both of us had every symptom. It was just psychosomatic. Because they were the normal things, you know, like fluish type of temperature and fever. So anyway, I got about 100 of those stories like that. And the chief justices and the Virginia chief justices and all were always a part of stories like that. But Chief Justice Carrico obviously was at one point in time the president of that conference and was just extremely highly regarded by all the people around the country.
Were you ever socializing here in Richmond with any of the justices?
Yes. The court would have various functions, and there were always bar functions and those types of things that we went to. So, the normal Christmas parties and birthday parties, and, you know, we always had those traditional office types of events. And so nothing unusual about that, and I'm sure there are some funny stories there, too, but they don't pop in my mind right now.
What about with your staff? Did you have any particularly close relationships with any of them, or, you know, was this kind of a generalized feeling about all of them?
No, I hope they felt the same way. I think they did, but I think we had an unbelievably close relationship because we had so many people that stayed there for so long and grew up together. We all came relatively young, and most of us stayed for a long period of time. And it was much more of a friendship type of thing than it was a work relationship type of thing. You know, our children grew up together, and we experienced all those life events that people do together. And I think I mentioned last time that it was, we had a lot of people who were very oriented toward doing good, and they were cause-oriented. And that made it fun because people worked unbelievably hard. I mean, when people were seeing they were making a contribution because we were building things that hadn't existed and creating something, you could see actually the fruits of your labor. It wasn't quite like it maybe later on when things get so big and so ensconced that it's pretty hard to change them. If something doesn't exist, it's not hard to create something. And so that's what we were doing. And so, yes, the answer is that we had lots and lots of just, and still do, lots and lots of friendships. I think I mentioned that I try to have a Christmas party every year and invite the people who, some of the old timers, the ones that have left. And it's always a great, great time together. But you know, we just had extremely capable people and extremely hardworking people. And I wouldn't have given anything for it. It was a very special, and as I said, I don't think I'm misstating this. I think most of the people would say the same thing. I'm sure that people didn't like everything that happened. No one ever likes everything that happened. But I am also sure that everybody knew that everybody's heart was in the right place and everybody was trying for the right motivation. That no one had a selfish motivation. No one had an advancement of my career motivation. Everybody had as their motivation improvement of the court system in this state, and I'm absolutely convinced of that, and nothing can ever take that away from those people that worked so hard over such a long period of time and were so successful at doing that too.
Now, you mentioned that there was a very low turnover rate among your staff. Did that make it difficult at any point to perhaps diversify your staff? Or was this,
I think the answer would be yes, particularly at the, what I'll call the senior level, or the, we call them directors of the various departments or divisions. And obviously if you have somebody who's in a job for 25 years and it doesn't change, then you're not going to be able to get into your senior leadership, any change in diversity. And that was true a lot. I mean, a lot of the directors were there for a very long period of time. Our turnover below that level was probably, although still, I would say it was probably exceeded the longevity of most, but it was still probably more typical of a normal business or governmental entity. Obviously, the lower down in the organization you went, the younger the people came to those jobs as entry-level jobs, And the younger the people who come to the jobs, the more likelihood, obviously, is that they're going to try to work their way up and they're going to move on to other places. We were still small enough that our promotional opportunities within that office, within the Office of the Executive Secretary, were limited. I mean, it was just not like you were going to have the same career path if you were with Philip Morris or Dominion or someplace like this. There were only so many jobs. Even if you came in at the lowest level, there were probably only two or three jobs above you. And if you had somebody who'd been in that job 20 years, that made it difficult. But those lower level, entry level positions were the jobs that we tended to see the greater diversity start to flow in. And as we could, obviously, at the upper level, that started to occur too. But that wasn't a problem. It was a problem if you looked at numbers and looked at diversity, but it wasn't a problem in the sense that we had good, capable, qualified people that are doing good work.
Approximately how many people were on your staff?
We had about 125, and plus consultants or forget the terminology, but you know, particularly in technology, people that we hired on just an ad hoc basis, but full-time work. Eventually, it started when I first got there, and this was part of one of the knocks on me. When I first got there, we probably had, well, I'm sure it was under 20 or something like that, and then it grew to about 125, 130 people. Now that's over 30 years, so it's not all that much. But a lot of the judges, even some of my closer friends, would always talk about empire building and all of those things, you know, building this big, huge bureaucracy and so forth. And some of them meant it, and some of them were just joking. But I think it's a legitimate issue to bring up. But it was, again, you have to look at the situation. If you're starting with ground zero and you have nothing, you know, the fact that you build real rapidly is not unusual at all. And of that number that I mentioned, I would say roughly half of those people were in technology. And so that was another thing, you know, that didn't exist until the late 70s, and then started to grow in the 80s, and then the mid 80s, you know, that takes off. And so, again, I could justify it on many different scales, but in all honesty, I think the office actually has grown a whole lot more since I left. One of the things that I had a judge say to me one time, actually one of the justices, I think, if I recall correctly, that actually I considered one of the greatest compliments I ever got, as a matter of fact, and he said, "You spend this money like it was your own." And that's true. You know, I wouldn't spend money on something if, you know, I spend it the same way I would have if I were doing it at my house. And most people don't throw money around willy-nilly when it's their own money. And so I always try to do that. We never ask for anything from the legislature that I didn't think was absolutely justified, and we couldn't soundly justify. In other words, we didn't go in and, you know, ask for 10 people because we needed two, you know, thinking that we could cut down or something like that. We never played those types of games, and sometimes that hurt. Sometimes I often felt that we were playing in an arena that had a certain set of rules, and that we played by a different set of rules, and sometimes that was to our disadvantage. But I think it was to our advantage from a credibility and from a reputation point of view, because I do think that we eventually came to be known as being people of our words that you could count on, and that people who weren't doing things just because that was something that should be done or could be done, it was something that needed to be done. One of the things we did fairly early on was look at the fact that people, the general public, was not sufficiently knowledgeable about the operation of the courts. And obviously we thought that the way to do that over the long haul was to talk about this to children and to get education about the court system into the schools. We did a lot of outreach to the public in general too, but if you're trying to solve a long-term problem, it's get them while they're young, I guess, is the answer. So we borrowed from Alabama a program that they had helped develop, and we Virginianized it and so forth, and called it Journey to Justice. And it was basically a K-12 social studies supplemental curriculum that basically taught the court the legal system and legal principles. And for example, in the earlier grades, it would be things as simple as stoplights indicating colors, but at the same time demonstrating the law, and that this is, you know, you need to stop at this intersection in order to maintain the flow of traffic and so forth. And so that was a classic example of something that I guess was a little bit outside the norm of things that the court system ought to be doing, but were some of the really fun things that I think made the job exciting and fun, but at the same time were productive and were helpful. And again, though, we probably weren't as successful as what we would have liked to have been there, because when you start something like that, you just don't think about the you don't think about the details of what it takes. And we found out, how do we get these things in the hands of everybody, the teachers? And just getting to find out who the socials, we first started talking about, well, we'll send it out to all the school superintendents, and we did that. But then it never got, we didn't have the sense it got any further than that, because we didn't think we could get it into the curriculum, because even at that time it was so full it would be very difficult, but we thought people would enjoy doing this. So eventually we did send it to the social studies teachers. We were able to get through the Department of Education with these names, and we sent it to all those people. And then that was great, except they leave and the books go with them, and they don't stay with the next person who comes in to teach it. So we never got a very satisfactory way of doing that. It was very spotty. It worked where it worked. I think it was good, but it was not as comprehensive as we'd like. I think since I left, there have been a greater effort to do that online. Obviously, that would be the modern day version of that. And Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, former justice on the United States Supreme Court, has done a good bit of work in those types of even putting them now into game programs. So that teaching, and where I am now at the National Center for the State Courts, one of the things that we do is called the graphic novel. Most people would call it a comic book, but the upscale version is called the graphic novel. And we've done three of those, basically teaching concepts about the judicial system using cases, the illegal downloading of music, for example. And we are putting those into school systems around the country. And all of these, I think, are just great things, but yet have not succeeded. We had at the Conference of Chief Justices not long ago, Richard Dreyfuss, who, I didn't realize this until the time, but one of his big things is actually civic education and outreach to school children. And he, through some foundation, had worked on the same types of things. So it's being worked on by an awful lot of people, but it's still not very successful, because by and large, every survey that you can think of, the public knows very little about. Sometimes it's very difficult for them to even name the three branches of government. Certainly almost no one can name more than one, if that many justices of the United States Supreme Court. I'm sure they could probably name none of the state Supreme Court. And again, it just means that I think we have a lot of work to do to make people, if people are going to be and exercise the rights of citizenship, they have to be knowledgeable to do that. And so we have to have